NASA has captured an image of what they're calling an apocalypse asteroid that could strike the Earth. The U.S. Space Agency snapped the image of a 500-meter-wide space rock using its spacecraft OSIRIS-REx during its orbit of the same space rock. The 1,600-foot asteroid, situated between Earth and Mars, get this, it weighs 87 million tons and is currently orbiting the Sun. In the picture, which you can see up at coasttocoastam.com, the asteroid can be seen looming on the right-hand side of the picture while Earth and the Moon are glowing in the bottom left corner. NASA has said there is a slim chance the asteroid could make impact with Earth on September 25th, 2135. If it does, it is estimated the energy unleashed during impact would be equivalent to 1,200 megatons. That's 80,000 times that released by the Hiroshima bomb. Again, you can read that at coasttocoastam.com, where our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, has posted that story. The Copper Scroll relic reads like a coded map, listing dozens of hiding spots where tithes and vessels and precious metal thought to be secreted from the Jewish temple were stored for safekeeping. Now, more than 50 years after, archaeologists found this unique artifact in a cave near Qumran. Four adventurers have dared to chase after the scroll's priceless relics, and we'll meet another of those, Jim Barfield, when my conversation with Shelley Neese continues right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you from Coast's in-depth, or Toronto, Canada affiliate, in-depth radio, News Talk 1010. Shelley Neese is with us, the author of The Copper Scroll Project. Now, before we get to another one of these central characters in this amazing story, Jim Barfield, let's just circle back for a moment to John Allegro, who was the first to sort of decipher the message on the Copper Scroll, this incredible treasure map. So what happens? I mean, obviously he's not able to excavate. What happens and why?
Well, so he wasn't able to excavate in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, which is a story that will keep, you know, that will keep being forbidden ground for the next decades till now. But he does, one of the second lines or the second locations in the Copper Scroll describes, so the Copper Scroll begins in the fortress, which is in the Valley of Achor, and then it goes on and it'll say in the Sepulchre Monument. So John Allegro identified a site called Hyrcania, which is similar to Masada, you know, a more famous site in Israel, but it's basically, it's one of the Herodian fortresses that is on the top of a mountain in the Judean desert that Herod had built himself, you know, in case the Jews ever rebelled against him, he could hide away in luxury on the top of the mountain until the rebellion was defeated. So Hyrcania was a location that had never been excavated, and it was one that John Allegro had identified that it was probably the fortress in the Valley of Achor that his translation was pointing to. And so he did actually excavate at Hyrcania. He excavated the top of the mountain, and like I said, he wasn't an archaeologist, so he proved to not really have the patient endurance. I think people kind of imagine archaeology is a little bit sexier than it actually is in reality, which is really hot, long, long days, you know, and really just painstaking. And so he hurried the process, and he didn't excavate the site like a professional would have or someone would have today, but he cleared buckets of sediment from the top of the mountain. But before he left the site, you know, and he has media, he has press, like he's kind of been promising something big and fast to those people that are there following him and to his volunteers. And what he finds is that actually at the base of Hyrcania were tunnels that had been filled in with 2,000 years of sediment that had blown in or had, you know, there's lots of flash floods in the area. And so it's pretty easy for those tunnels to have been filled in by debris over that 2 millennia. But he actually sees something in those tunnels, because the Copper Scroll also mentions steps entering to the east, and the tunnels were eastward facing, and this was the fortress and the Valley of Accord. So he kind of puts all these clues together, and he thinks that the tunnels might be leading to Copper Scroll treasure. And he excavates, he does take out just tons and tons of sediment, but eventually, even for those two, there were two tunnels 200 yards apart, eventually for both of those tunnels, he's going to realize that it's dangerous, you know, that the further down the tunnel, and kind of imagine it cuts into the mountain the same way entries into the Egyptian pyramids do. It's like at a 35 degree angle down. So the further you go down and the further you get into the earth, the more dangerous it becomes, that it might collapse on top of you. And also just the less oxygen you have, the less light. And so it got more dangerous. And so he actually abandoned the task. Later on, Allegro will be retired and he'll be living in England, and actually a kind of crazy pilot, an airline pilot, an American, will read Allegro's account and just be, you know, mystified that Allegro could have left those tunnels unexcavated, and certain that he was on to the right spot. And so he will frequent Israel and secretly dig out those tunnels for the process of 15 years, a process of a decade, really, and then he'll eventually fess up to the Israeli Antiquities Authority of what he's doing. But he'll secretly and covertly keep excavating those tunnels for years.
How is it possible to secretly excavate something like that? This is a huge undertaking.
Totally. So he was doing it all by himself, which is super dangerous. It's the part of the Judean desert, you know, there's no communities there. There's no one living there. Just, you know, Bedouins might roam that area, but otherwise he would, whether or not, you know, he would be flying through Israel, or, you know, he's an airline pilot, so he was able to get there pretty quickly, but he would rent a car, drive the car as far as he could, and then have to walk the rest of the way on foot. Hyrcania is actually in an Israel Defense Forces. It's a firing range. So they practice military exercises out there. So a lot of times he would have to hide in the tunnel during the daytime to be out of sight. And then using lights and other things would dig at night. It's kind of an insane story. His name was Bob Morgan. Eventually, though, it's going to be harder for him to get oxygen. You know, it's harder for him to he realizes that he can't do it alone. And he approaches Hebrew University and finds an Israeli archaeologist named Oren Gutfeld. And Oren Gutfeld was young at the time and just seemed like something worth going to check out. And so he went and saw the tunnels, and he sees that along the, you know, these very unusual tunnels, I mean, what are they leading to? No one can say. And he sees what Bob Morgan's done. He sees what John Allegro started, and there's little oil niches along the walls. I mean, just everything that would just sort of tease an archaeologist to want to know what was at the end of that tunnel. He never said that he was digging, you know, archaeologists will never say that they're digging for Copper Scroll treasure. That makes them look like a treasure hunter instead of an archaeologist. So he never said it was Copper Scroll related, but Oren Gutfeld will spend the next 8 dig seasons. So over the course really of another 10 years excavating those tunnels until he gets to the end. And at the end, it was a dead end. So all of that time, all of that work, 3 different men, all haunted by the Copper Scroll in their own way, excavate the Hyrcania tunnels thinking that they'll lead to Copper Scroll treasure, and they dead end. I've met with Oren Gutfeld. He's a friend at this point, and he says that he couldn't speak for days after the tunnels dead ended.
This is all starting to sound a little bit like the treasure of Oak Island. Dead ends and so forth. But by the by, what is the estimated value of the treasure that we're talking about? Can it even be quantified?
No, you can't put a price tag on it, especially since we're talking about potential temple furniture and vessels.
But just the precious metal alone, I mean, we're looking at, gold around $1,300 an ounce U.S.
Right.
And we're talking
so
about
multiply that times
tons and tons.
Exactly.
Oh, my word. So when does this retired firefighter from Oklahoma City, Jim Barfield, enter the race for the Copper Scroll treasure?
Right. So Jim Barfield he's such a unique character. And I mean, at this point, I've been following his story for a decade of my life. And so at once, I think in the beginning, I tried to write this story as an investigative journalist, but tried to, following someone closely for 10 years and not feeling, like an attached cheerleader. Jim Barfield is a retired arson investigator from Oklahoma. What makes him really interesting is that, he'll self-deprecate a lot and say that, he has no formal education and that the only letters behind his name are to, that he's certified to drive a fire truck. But in reality, he's like someone that I've never known before in terms of just very self-educated. He's studied the Dead Sea Scrolls in the firehouse whenever he was even just a young fireman and killing time either on the fire truck or in the firehouse, he would be studying the Dead Sea Scrolls, which, is not a normal human story. But he was actually very bored by the Copper Scroll because, there's 900 other Dead Sea Scroll manuscripts to study, all of which either are from the Bible or ancient commentaries on the Bible or ways that this sectarian sect lived at Qumran. So super fascinating and interesting. The Copper Scroll is a dry inventory, so it didn't have any spiritual significance for him, and so he never really gave the Copper Scroll much thought. But over the course of time, he started to do something he called the Messiah timeline. And so he would read the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he would plot the dates that it mentioned. The Dead Sea Scrolls talk about the foundation of their own community, will give other historical points. And so he would just plot them on a timeline chronologically. And then he would read the Bible, and he would do the same with the Bible and with prophecies. And he was just trying to figure out if he could to use his Messiah timeline to point out sort of events that would roll out, like the destruction of Jerusalem and other things that the prophets were pointing towards. And he met with Vendel Jones. Vendel Jones is the most famous and the most controversial of all of the Copper Scroll enthusiasts.
Perhaps the inspiration for Harrison Ford's character of Indiana Jones.
Exactly. So Vendel Jones is a unique, character in his own right and deserves his own book. But and he since passed away. But Vendel Jones searched for Copper Scroll treasure for 30 years. And so it was suggested to Jim to meet with Vendel Jones to show him his Messiah timeline just as a point of reference for the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, Vendel Jones lives, eats, and breathes the Copper Scroll. So he actually didn't care much about Jim's timeline. He just kept telling him over and over how important the Copper Scroll was and how actually that the Copper Scroll gave more history and more context than any of the other Dead Sea Scrolls. And so really after that meeting, Jim Barfield went home, not with any particular interest in the sites that Vendel Jones had been looking at in Israel for Copper Scroll treasure, but just sort of reinvigorated to look at the Copper Scroll with some intention. And the way he tells the story is that he was just in his office and studying, and he's the kind of man who happened to have an aerial map of Qumran on his desk, and he gets an English translation of the Copper Scroll. It's one of the more well-known ones by Gabriel Garcia Martinez. He has a book with all of the Dead Sea Scrolls in English. And so he's just looking at this very, well-accepted translation of the Copper Scroll, and he sees that the Copper Scroll begins, according to this translation, in the valley under the ruins, in the valley of Achor. And so he just looks and he thinks, you know, the traditional and the accepted place of the Valley of Achor, and looks for ruins in that area, or thinks about ruins in that area. In Qumran are the most famous and the most connected to the Dead Sea Scrolls. So he just takes that first line as a preamble, which everyone else had always taken that line as just referring to that first location. And so what, just right off the bat and instinctively, what he did that was different, that will affect the rest of his research for a decade, is that he took it as a preamble of, like, all of the next locations listed in this scroll will be in the ruin, which is in the Valley of Achor. So it's important that I identify that ruin. And he just thought to himself, I'm going to see if the archaeological remains of Qumran match the rest of the locations listed in the Copper Scroll. And that's where it began.
In other words, all of the treasure is right there in Qumran, where the scrolls were discovered.
Exactly. Other people, other scholars have thought, you know, with passing reference, only John Allegro actually, you know, really nailed down a couple of locations that he identified with Qumran and the Copper Scroll. Certainly other scholars have thought it, there seems to be matches here because of the proximity. You know, the Copper Scroll was just found steps away from Qumran. It's associated with all of the other Dead Sea Scrolls. The authors and owners of the Dead Sea Scrolls were the Essenes who lived at Qumran. And so, I mean, it's kind of a flash of the obvious in some ways. So really what Jim Barfield was doing that was unique and new was giving a method and a rhyme and a reason to how does Qumran match the Copper Scroll exactly, and is it possible that all 60 of the locations are actually in Qumran and buried underneath Qumran, or at least on the edges or around Qumran, because the Copper Scroll never takes you anywhere else. After it says in the ruin, which is in the Valley of Achor, all of the identifications are very specific after that. You know, after that, we're just talking about dry cisterns and wells and ritual immersion pools. And so it never really indicates that you do need to go somewhere else. The very next line, and this is one of my favorites just right off the bat, but the Copper Scroll begins, it says, pass under the steps leading to the east 40 cubits. And so it was pretty easy for Jim Barfield to look at an aerial map and say, are there steps facing east in Qumran? And so he just orients his map to the cardinal directions of a compass, and he sees that there are steps heading east. And then he wonders, well, how can I find out if those eastward facing stairs are 40 cubits long? And it turns out that there had just been an archaeological report that was published at an excavation that was 10 years long, and they included in that report the length of the stairs, and it was exactly 40 cubits. And so he goes from there, just matching it up one at a time. And sometimes they're very, very specific. Like, and obviously that report, it didn't use cubic measurements in the report. It used meters. But, you know, once he converted it to the cubit system, then it was exactly 40.
So a retired firefighter breaks the code and discovers the location, perhaps, of this vast treasure that is encoded in the Copper Scroll. We'll come back. More of my conversation with Shelley Neese, the Copper Scroll Project. The Beatles taking us into the break with While My Guitar Weeps, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Many explorers have fallen prey to the Copper Scroll's siren call, spending their lifetime searching for the artifacts that promise to alter human history. Did Jim Barfield, this retired firefighter from Oklahoma, finally crack the code? We'll find out when my conversation with Shelley Neese continues, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Shelley Neese. We're talking about the Copper Scroll Project, and of the few, and I'm cribbing here from Shelley Neese's website, of the few who have risked their careers and reputations to search for Copper Scroll treasures, only one remains He's an unlikely hero, a fireman from Oklahoma, an award-winning investigator named Jim Barfield, who treated the Copper Scroll like evidence in an arson case and came to an astonishing realization. All of the locations described in the Copper Scroll have exact architectural matches with Qumran, this rather unimpressive ruin perched on a plateau just off the coast of Israel's Dead Sea. At what point does Jim actually travel to Israel to test his theory?
Good question. So it was after he identified the first 20 locations. It's not that, you know, he never says and that, you know, that God told him that the Copper Scroll treasure was here. He never sort of lays down any trump cards, but he just kept at it. I mean, he's just a person who, once he gets hold of a thread, he's going to follow it all the way through. So it was once he identified the first 20 locations in the Copper Scroll and saw that they all had architectural matches in Qumran, that is when he had to get on a plane and go and see it in person himself and sort of walk the Copper Scroll on the ground at Qumran. Because for one, he also didn't know if he couldn't tell what the flooring was like either. So, you know, he might be able to match up ritual immersion pools or great cisterns or peristyles or courtyards with all things listed in the Copper Scroll. But what he didn't know is if he could, if anybody would be able to break through that ground or if it would be threatening to the ruin itself. And so he flew there with his wife, and that was the first time he had ever been to Israel, was to see if his Copper Scroll translation was correct.
And what was his motivation? Was he a treasure seeker, or was this a spiritual quest?
So, no, it was definitely spiritual. He says, and I really, after knowing him for a decade, I know that this is true, that he just wants these items to be found and returned to Israel, and he has no ulterior motives. He considers this to be Israel's birthright, or, you know, there's no other motive. And it's also not as if anyone would be able to establish any monetary value on these things anyways. Now, he is a really religious man, a very, very strict keeping in with the Sabbath and with laws of the Torah, but also is a believer in Jesus. And so he kind of occupies both orbits. He's a little bit of a religious chameleon in that way, that when he's with a group of Jews, that he speaks the language of Torah and of what's important to religious Jews, but he also is great with Christian audiences. So I see him kind of navigate both of those worlds and do it well, because both are important to him.
At this point, does the technology exist to do sort of ground penetrating imaging? Can they see what's under the ground?
Right. So the technology has come a long way. Like you referenced Oak Island, you know, every time that they hit a wall, they always just get a new grand piece of technology to keep the plot moving. But what was the problem 50 years ago is that even when there were metal detectors, even when metal detecting technology existed, this is the Dead Sea area. So the soil there is mineralized in a very different way than any other place in the world. And so metal detectors just gave false positives or weren't able to read the soil in the right way. And so in the beginning, when Qumran was excavated, metal detectors weren't very useful. Jim Barfield, one part is that, so ground penetrating radar has been done at Qumran, but not for what we were looking for in the Copper Scroll, because the Copper Scroll, it's where it occupies some space between, this isn't traditional archaeology. Traditional archaeology digs down to the last level of habitation, and when that's reached, you stop. The Copper Scroll is asking you to dig 9 to 12 feet deeper than that, and to dig for something that was buried. So it's a really unnatural process for archaeologists to pursue that. And so the ground penetrating radar that had been done does show voids at Qumran. It does show that there are underground sort of storage areas. Randall Price from Liberty University had done a lot of that work on the Qumran Plateau, and he too has found voids there that he hasn't been able to excavate. Some of them cut into a cliff. There's like a very steep wadi that drops right at the edge of Qumran, so you have to be careful even in excavating caves or anything in that area because it's very collapsible. So we did get our hands on a Lorenz DeepMax metal detector, which is probably the best metal detector for that region. A Weitz metal detector is strong, but Lorenz is a $10,000 metal detector when you add in the technology between being able to read the scans. And it's a cube. It's a cube that you drag, and it can tell the difference between ferrous and non-ferrous metals. So it can tell the difference, you know, if we're looking for gold, silver, or bronze or something else. And it can give some indication of size and depth, which is really what had to be done for the copper scroll.
And what did it reveal?
Well, so for years, so I have to back it up a little. In 2009, and this is just a crazy sort of chronology of events that even Jim Barfield was able to do this, but he was able to get a meeting with the Israel Antiquities Authority and to excavate at three of the sites that were listed in his research, which how this Oklahoma artisan investigator was able to get a meeting with the Israel Antiquities Authority and much less for them to want to test and probe his research is a tome within itself. But he was able to do it. And so what became clear in that process is that the copper scroll lists 60 locations. And so if you dig all over Qumran at that kind of depth in 60 different sites, you'll destroy Qumran in the process. You'll end up making Qumran look like an up-close shot of the moon, you know, just craters everywhere. And so even though he had specific research that pointed to specific places, Qumran is a sacred site in and of itself to Israel and to the religious community. And so he had to be really careful. And so it became clear that doing 9-foot probes in Qumran proper was not ideal. And so for many years, he applied after that dig. That dig was abruptly shut down for reasons that I can speculate on, but we don't know for sure. And that archaeologist that had been in charge of the dig and who had really believed in Jim Barfield's research, and he was the number two person in command of Qumran from an archaeological level, he actually died in a tragic cave accident not so long after. And so it really kind of brought everything to a halt. And for whatever reason, the Israel Antiquities Authority denied permission to do an electronic scan of Qumran. And for years, it sat that way. For years, Jim Barfield was applying. He was finding new archaeologists. He was writing new reports, meeting with new leaders, sometimes waiting out people to retire in the Antiquities Authority. And so
he returned to Israel something like 16 times.
Right.
16 times.
Right, exactly. So
this guy's tenacious. He's tenacious.
So tenacious. And every time, you know, kind of building up this army of allies, a lot of people in the Temple Mount movement, a lot of religious Jews who see a third temple in Israel's future, really have aligned with Jim Barfield and want him to succeed. Nothing has ever been found from the interior of the first or second temple. We have plenty of exterior evidence from the temples. You know, the retaining walls are still there. We have things that a stone that marks the place of trumpeting. We have priestly weights and scales. We have things, but we don't have. So certainly, you know, there's no denying the existence of the Jewish temple, but because of 2,000 years of invaders and occupations and Jerusalem being destroyed and rebuilt back up, and because we can't excavate on the Temple Mount, there's really nothing from the ritual vessels or the religious vessels that we have, there was one tiny pomegranate that was found that was believed to be on the end of a priestly scepter, and it had an inscription that said, from the house of Yahweh or in the house of Yahweh, and it has been proved to be a forgery, which brings us back to zero in terms of what we can sort of, the banner that the Temple Mount movement can march under, that they would love for Jim Barfield to be successful. So he really has sort of this religious cohort of allies that have championed around him, but just, yes, for years was knocking on the wrong doors and really getting nowhere in terms of the antiquities authority approving a permit, which the archaeologists that we worked with really couldn't even understand. It said he had never been denied a permit for something like that before because it was non-invasive. It wasn't threatening to the ruins, especially when we were able to get a hold of the Lorenz, which is a much better metal detector. So it was really a frustrating time period.
I understand he even met with a member of the modern day Sanhedrin.
Yes, yeah, he met with the whole Sanhedrin. So, right, twice. And he presented his whole research. He's a report writer for Comanche Nation College in Oklahoma. And so after he retired from arson investigation, he actually taught report writing at a community college. But anyways, he wrote you should see his report is 265 pages filled with maps and descriptions and translations and graphic images of the Copper Scroll. And just, it's a pretty amazing piece of work in and of itself. And so he's bringing it to these meetings. And so he presented the Sanhedrin with his research. He's presented lots of people in Israel with his research, all who seem to thump their heads in disbelief, thinking that the answer's been there this whole time, that Qumran has held this secret the whole time. And so that's, yeah, he's gone up the religious ladder as high as it can go.
Right. So is it a stubborn bureaucracy? Is it a fear that by unearthing these treasures that it will somehow ignite political disputes, land claims, ignite a Middle East war? What is the fear here? What's at stake?
So probably yes to all of those. Technically, by Israel's archaeological laws, Qumran is Area C, which means that Qumran is not Israel proper, and should Israel, in a peace process, ever be reignited, Qumran would be under negotiation, or that area of Israel would be under negotiation and potentially part of a new Palestinian state. And so by the Geneva Convention standards, whatever comes out of that area, whatever is unearthed and excavations in that area, is disputed property because the land is disputed. And so Israel, actually, when I say that he was working with the Israel Antiquities Authority, that's not entirely true, because it's a military wing of the Israel Antiquities Authority. It's its own institution. And technically, when something is found in that area, it can be studied and it can be researched and published by the archaeologist or the scholar that found it, but it goes in a military warehouse afterwards until the land is no longer in dispute. So that part of Indiana Jones is fair and accurate, that this would, technically be boxed up in a crate with a stamp Ark of Covenant on it. So in some ways, maybe they're being wise. Maybe the Antiquities Authority is smart in the same ways that we do this in other parts of the world, that there are other terracotta soldiers in China and that they're saving them to be excavated at a future date when we know that the paint won't immediately come off of them. Or, in Egypt with the pyramids, that we know that there are voids, but maybe you wait out a better technology that can test that better and more accurately. So there are other international examples of playing the waiting game with archaeology and waiting out the process and for the technology to advance. In Israel's case, it's they might be waiting out the political conversation and then standards. And in that case, maybe it's a wise move. Certainly a lot of Israel's struggle is always, you know, if something is pulled out of the ground, if it is the Ark of the Covenant or the altar of incense, will there immediately be conspiracies that they faked it, you know, that it wasn't real, that Israel's just doing this to lay more land claims? And so I think that there's a lot there, but it's a different time in Israel, and Israel's acting bolder now than it had been, even just with the previous administration and then America. And so I think that we might be in a new day just in terms of Israel's guts to do something like this.
Just very quickly, we're heading into a break. Does Jim Barfield believe that the Ark of the Covenant is beneath these ruins in Qumran?
He does. He actually believes that it's in a cave outside of Qumran. And after the break, I'll tell you why we know that something is there.
All right. Let's do that on the other side. We'll also open up the phone lines and take questions and comments for Shelley Neese, the author of The Copper Scroll Project, An Ancient Secret Fuels the Battle for the Temple Mount. Now, taking us into the break, Rod Stewart's version of Ooh La La, covered by Rod in 1998 in tribute to the recently deceased Ronnie Lane, a former bandmate in The Faces. Back with more on The Copper Scroll, right here on Coast to Coast AM.